Welcome to AMO Kenzoku, episode 73. We are a group of four bubblegum crisis boomer otaku who talk about all things anime, manga, and other subjects we find interesting. The Kenzoku are...
Hey all, I'm Mike.
I'm Sam.
I'm Dylan.
And I am tonight's host, Nick. This week's episode is going to be focusing on the 1995 OVA, Armitage III. And with that, Ashin.
Self-correction, which is at the end of our last episode, I called it Armitage III, which is incorrect. It's the third.
Yeah, it is the third because it is three, the Roman numeral III, which, if you're thinking about people's names, is indeed read the third. So, here we go. Per usual, I think I'd like to start first with the kind of some of the key staff before we get into the meat of it. So right off the bat, something I found interesting was that it was both, the original OVA was both directed and character designed by the same person, which I think is pretty unusual. So that's by Hiroyuki Ochi, who doesn't have a whole lot to his name. He did a few things before Armitage in the 80s, so, you know, things like, gosh, I'm trying to see anything here. So he did Hakenden, he worked on Detonator Oregon, AD Police, did key animation for that, key animation for Angel Cop, and then he has random credits for things up to relatively recent things like Grand Blue and Tsugumomo, but not a ton of directing under his name. So
he's,
I would
got
say
a,
he's
a lot of key animation, like throughout.
He does. Yeah. So anime, that, which explains why he could direct and character design, because mm-hmm. that seems to be more his wheelhouse. I would say one of the more interesting also staffers is the writer, Chiaki J. Konaka, who's quite a bit more prolific, basically wrote for the screenplay for Serial Experiments Lane, as well as Technolize, so, you know, two of Abe's real prominent IPs. And I think I see some kind of similar themes in Armitage, so I can definitely see the kind of DNA there. And then, lastly, also interestingly enough, the music by Hiroyuki Namba, who actually doesn't have a ton of anime or OVA kind of credits to his name, like obviously Armitage, and then most recently worked on Space Dandy, as well as the first OVA, Daedalus, in 83. And then Dylan, I think you pointed out earlier that he actually has quite a bit in the game sphere as well. He actually has done a lot of Falcom soft stuff, so music from East, as well as Sorcerian. So, you know, all those have pretty stellar soundtrack. So, and that, I would say that's one of the areas of Armitage I'm also particularly attached to, is the soundtrack. At least for the OVA, I enjoyed the soundtrack quite a lot. Kind of that industrial prog rock sound. So yeah, before we move on to plot, one of the things that is kind of interesting about the IP is how you watch it, because as far as I know, there's no official platform that actually streams it. So I, being the dinosaur that I am, actually own the original Pioneer DVDs for both the OVA as well as Dual Matrix, the follow-up movie from 2002. So that's how I ended up watching it, and watching it in Japanese language. What about you, Mike?
Yeah, I also have the ancient Pioneer DVD. I have all of them, though I only watched the original OVA for this episode, but I think whichever ones I didn't already have were picked up at the Pioneer Jenny on Fire sales when they went out of business.
Oh yeah, when they were going for like $3 and $5.
Yeah, it was like 25 discs for 100, I think.
Oh yeah.
That's the good old days. What about you, Sam?
I watched the Blu-ray version that had been extracted from the Blu-ray that I found somewhere. I found somebody dropped it on the street and I found it.
Got it. Yeah. Understood. Not nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Yeah.
How was the quality of it?
It was pretty good, actually. Like,
okay.
I mean, I did, accidentally also get a quote-unquote normal version, and yeah, the quality was much better. It was noticeably a Blu-ray. Like, it didn't have that that quite feel of cell animation, you know, like how some of the older stuff you can see the grain in the film. Like, I think they kind of over smoothed it a bit, but
I see.
But you know, still it was good. It was very clean. So
I'm guessing it didn't have
having to import that.
Obviously, from composite master rainbowing and dot crawl that the DVDs have a bit. Yeah.
No, it didn't have that.
Yeah, that piques my interest. I might have to just bite the bullet and import it now, since, as far as I know, that's the JP Blu-ray is still the only one that exists, as far as modern releases. What about you, Dylan?
I watched OVA, Polymatrix, and Dual Matrix as the Lord intended, dubbed in English, on from YouTube rips. So it's just all up on YouTube, which made it very easy to watch.
Awesome. So we actually get multiple different perspectives.
So which one was the Kiefer Sutherland one?
That's Polymatrix. That's the Elizabeth Berkeley Kiefer Sutherland. And actually, interestingly, the I forget his name. The guy at the police department who wears the hat.
Mm-hmm.
He was voiced by Bryan Cranston.
Really?
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Man, back
like,
when
he was probably he was just probably one of those side things, you know, a small gig or whatever. But I was like, huh, interesting.
I mean, he was wasn't he in like Macross Plus?
Yeah,
he might have been too
on at least some of it. And that was also a Magnitude 8 post dub. I'm curious whether I know the OVA was. I'm trying to see if Polymatrix was.
And then for Dual Matrix, then it wasn't Berkeley. It was Juliette Lewis, because they had already established themselves as going for someone that's like a name brand thing with the dub. Why did I watch it as the dub? I don't know why. One, it was easy and it was there and I was like, okay. And it was also one of those things that I remember the show being advertised so heavily with, like, dub by Kiefer Sutherland and Elizabeth Berkeley. It was like, so I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go with this.
I want to say it's probably one, I believe it's the first kind of anime anything that was really heavily kind of advertised as having, you know, big time, I guess we can call it Hollywood talent as the voices. I cannot remember another one where it was advertised before this.
So. Yeah, I remember constantly seeing like ads, like posters, probably in Suncoast. I don't remember where I saw them, but like, it was a big deal. It had like, I remember seeing it all over the place. I know that trailers were all over, of course, every anime thing you watched from certain people. Because I remember the opening so well, despite only having watched it like once forever ago. But they play that opening stuff for every trailer. But Dylan, I'm curious, you bought the thing on the Apple TV, didn't you?
That's true. That is true. I did do that. So what they had available on Apple TV for like $4 was the original OVA dubbed.
Okay.
Did not have a Japanese language track on it.
Yeah, okay. That's what I was afraid of.
Yep.
It's only $4 for all of it, though. It's about $1 an episode. So
yeah, yep. that's not a bad deal. But what I want to know is what masters they are.
I feel like at least the way that I watched it, and some of it could also have been the cleaned up stuff, that I felt that the Polymatrix looked a lot nicer than the OVA. So it might have been that the OVA was like, I don't know which, maybe it was, I mean, it presumably was the whatever is a US release of it. Because it's not like they would have gone through and gotten the 2022 or whatever Japanese Blu-ray release.
No way.
Yeah, there's no way. So, I don't know where I'm going with that. So I'll stop talking.
Okay. That was a mystery that I wanted solved. So I'm glad to finally have that solved.
So we discussed dub voice acting, but also for the remaining three of us who watched it in Japanese, I won't say the the voice cast was super star-studded, at least for the era, but I will say there's some notables. So it's an Armitage voiced by Kasahara Hiroko, who I think in this group, the only other thing we probably would remember is she was Azalyn in Irresponsible Captain Tyler, probably the other more notable role. So, you know, I thought her performance was great. I would say big notables are Don Claude was voiced by Ryusei Nakao, who is Frieza in Dragon Ball. So, you know, like, I mean, iconic love, that cackling, yeah. Just, I can't even mimic it. It's just such an iconic, yeah. Just yeah. Such an iconic smoker's long laugh.
Yeah. And
man, like, he played the perfect villain in this as far as just being this absolute psychopath. Genius psychopath at that.
Definitely and then, of an era character.
Oh, for yeah, sure. For sure. And then I think almost super apt, Julian, our favorite, I don't even know how to describe his style, but our favorite male third, voiced by Megumi Ogata, who is Shinji in Evangelion. So perfect casting choice there. I feel like it's like one-to-one perfect choice.
Wait, which one was Julian?
Julian is the brother, air quotes, the the hacker brother that ends up
Pluto
helping out.
Pluto.
Yes, he was Pluto. Yes.
Yeah, okay.
What's his code name? So, you know, he was for the whopping 1.25 episodes. He was in.
Yeah.
Although I mean, it's only 4 eps, so I guess even being in one is notable enough. All right, so before going too much further, I should probably say we're probably going to be spoilering away, so anybody interested, you know, watch it in any of the formats that we just described. Hopefully one day, it looks like at some point Crunchy was streaming it, but it was lapsed at some point. It may have been after the Funimation IPs.
I think that's lapsed. Something that came across with the from Funimation and not from Crunchyroll, and they just like never put it online, but yeah, there's like a placeholder for it, which is weird.
Yeah, if they have it, they might as well just put it up. But in any case, yeah. I mean, you know, I personally have a soft spot for this since I, you know, it's this probably more than anything represents the 90s for me, and anime. This and Eva are like pretty much the flag bearers for like 90s anime for me. But,
so why is that for you? Did you watch it like in 95 or something?
I pretty much watched it as soon as it came here. I was definitely in middle school when this came out, which would have put it in between 1992 to 1995. So yeah, I would have been in middle school when this came out. And it was just kind of in a giant pile of VHS tapes that one of my sister's friends, who was a, you know, big time anime dealer, kind of like a drug dealer back then, who you just had illicit anime that, you know, nobody else could get. And this was among them. And something about Armitage really resonated with me and stuck with me, honestly, till now. When I think cyberpunk anime, I still think Armitage for before anything else, even before Cyberpunk 2077, Edgerunners, which is obviously excellent. But I still feel like for me, anime cyberpunk is epitomized by Armitage. For better or for worse, I think there's plenty of IPs that do it well, but for me, it's just Armitage holds a special place in my heart. And I will say, a lot of it at first, I thought a lot of it was nostalgia glasses, but I don't know. I think it holds up pretty well, plot wise. I don't know what the rest of you think.
I don't want to dump on it. I mean, I have my criticisms. Like it's
for sure. It's, yeah, go for it.
It's a flawed work, but. Like, I'll say, the first episode, and I'm curious to hear how people who watched the movie versions or whatever, did anybody watch the movie versions?
I did.
Okay. It kind of drags, and at least the first episode is way too long, I think. It's kind of boring at parts, and it's kind of cliche, but I think the latter two episodes are pretty good, and I was fully engaged at that point. The ending is great as well.
I can agree. I think the first ep didn't need to be a 48 minute or whatever ep it was. I think it could have been a half hour and still done what it needed to do. I can agree with that.
The animation also was kind of wonky in the early ones too, and which I was kind of surprised for an OVA at that time.
It's certainly not a, I would call, stellarly, like, amazingly animated OVA. I think it's animated okay. I mean, I feel like that's kind of a sign of AIC. I feel like AIC isn't exactly known for, you know, the highest fidelity and stuff, right? Even from the 90s especially. Like, this was, I would say, very efficiently animated. And I would say, for me, a lot of it is carried by the characters, the setting, and the music. I think animation definitely, I kind of turn a blind eye to it.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
I can't cover that part up. It is not a great representation of stellar animation.
I think pointing out the AIC's role in it is pretty good, because that is definitely a signature of AIC, is kind of middling animation. Mm-hmm. But again, it did pick up near the end, so I give them credit there. Just maybe they spent, like, it being long, probably just the whole thing suffered because that first episode was as long as it was.
For whatever reason, when it decided to have flashes of, like, cute or silly, and they just animated them, it didn't feel like it matched the rest of the character designs as well as most 90s stuff does. Like, it just felt like I was watching some other anime for a little bit and then went back to the seriousness.
Like, which part? Could you have an example?
It was more noticeable in episode one, where just Armitage would, you know, you would just have a shot of Armitage looking cute for some reason that felt out of place. I remember thinking that at the time.
Sure, I see.
I almost view that as kind of the, lack of better term, the charm of the character. Like, she definitely weaponizes her sex appeal, right? Like, she, you know, the way she dresses is, like, compared to the rest of the police forces, like, everybody's in uniform, except, like, detectives aren't, and then she's in, like, you know, leather hot pants, and I can't even describe the rest of it, but, right, so, you know, but at the same time, it's like she's given the free pass because she's, you know, it's inferred she's, like, their best field operative.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think one thing I can get on board with is that while they weaponized her sex appeal for sure, and that's, you know, obviously it's in full display in the opening, like, it's basically opening is her getting dressed, but I think it's still done in a way where it doesn't demean the character, at least the way I interpret it. Like, she's using it because she knows that it's a strength, and and she's leveraging it to, you know, do what she needs to do, but I don't think she's necessarily being taken advantage of because of it. People try, and obviously there's that scene, and I think what's the beginning of the second ep with the weird creepy guys in the alleyway, the Stanley Kubrick looking guys saying, like, she's like, and she, you know, she's approaching them, you know, hey, do you know a writer? And he's like, oh, I wrote a porno, ha ha ha, drool, pulls out a knife, and then she literally, you know, like, annihilates him. But I don't, especially if when you consider when this was done, like, you think about the kinds of shows and OVAs releasing in the 90s and how dated the sensibilities can be. I won't abjectly, you know, name drop any, but, you know, I can think of a couple of AIC properties that are definitely fall into that category. I feel like overall, like, everything Armitage, I feel like, holds up to modern sensibilities pretty well. Like, I wouldn't be super uncomfortable showing this to, like, any younger anime people, or even my wife for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
Having watched the OVA and the Polymatrix versions, I think I would recommend the Polymatrix version, because it condenses it down to an hour and a half, and it does take out some of that extra stuff. You still get a lot of what I think is, in my head, was, like, a lot of the problems with it was kind of, like, the sudden jump cuts and, like, script and everything, where you feel like, wait, what the heck? Why are we over here? It's like, you still have that, but I don't think there's really a way to do that. I also think they went through and did, like, some cleanup on some of the animation and stuff when they made it.
Oh.
And then I liked the ending a lot better Because at the end of the, at the end of the OVA, it just kind of like, they, I'll call it the epilogue part, where it's like, I guess Ross has been gone for a couple of months or something, and he comes back and he gives her a fake ID that clearly was a lot of work to get, and she just tosses it away. Like,
yeah, that was a bit weird.
Like, she just tosses it away and is like, I don't need this fake ID. By the way, I'm pregnant, yo. Like, let me toss out this thing that could be a lifeline to help take care of a kid or whatever. They cut that whole part out, and they just kind of like redid it with a little scene with her and Ross, like, talking about, I forget exactly what it was, but it was more kind of like philosophical talking, and there wasn't anything that was like, oh, months later and he comes back and then she throws away this hard fought fake ID. So I like,
I
that.
Mean, I don't know. I didn't think the end of the OVA was that wrong. I think I'm reading into it a bit more than others, but like, for me, the messaging at the end of the OVA was, you know, basically the entirety of society is basically against the existence of thirds because of this treaty between Earth and Mars, right? And Earth views the existence of thirds as a fundamental, you know, threat to subjugating Mars, because they want to have Mars and Earth align. And, you know, Mars being the more liberal, right, kind of wild west of things. I mean, we saw the red light district stuff. And in any case, I think Armitage, you know, taking the rejecting the ID is her still saying, you know, she doesn't want to reject the fact that she's a third and wants to keep, you know, some part of that resistance, for lack of a better term, alive. And, you know, also it is a bit of a kind of a jarring thing, which is, oh yeah, and by the way, we have a kid on the way, and that's, but at the same time, that's like the whole purpose of thirds existing.
Yeah.
So I get why they did that.
That'd be a weird, I don't know, Chekhov's gun to not, you know, to do anything with.
Yeah.
So
yeah, but I can see how, yeah, it's viewed like he just did. But that also kind of, that fact also makes the reason why I didn't necessarily recommend Dual Matrix, the follow-up movie, was I feel like there's a lot more incongruencies in that one than in the original OVA, and in general I don't agree thematically with a lot of it, so that's why there are parts of it I enjoy, but I also feel like the movie didn't need to be an hour and a half long. I think an hour and a half was way too long for the
movie,
personally. Yeah, I think there was a lot that could have cut out.
But... So when you say follow-up, what do you mean? Like, is it...
So the true sequel, Dual
Okay,
Matrix.
It is a sequel, though. Okay.
Yes, it is a true sequel. So to give the context, it was released in 2002, so quite a bit later. It was... Most of the staff and cast were replaced. Ochi was retained, but only as the character designer, I believe. And then everybody else... was different, writing staff, even the voice cast was different, so it seemed like a completely different thing to me. I appreciate some of it, because like it gives a little bit more more to the story of Ross and Armitage, but at the same time, it almost is like, I would have been okay with it just being like an epilogue OVA episode, because to me, fundamentally, it makes almost no sense that they both basically risk everything that they had built in their little safe haven, right? Like, for me, the message at the end was the whole world and the whole universe is against them, but at least they have each other and now they can start their family. Yeah, they're going to be on the run, but, you know, at least they'll have each other. And in my opinion, take the small win, right? Like, I like the fact that it's a happy-ish ending, but it's realistic, right? Like, there's no fundamental way two individuals can stop two planetary governments, so they're just trying to survive, and I was okay with that messaging. In the beginning of Dual Matrix, it's, you see a few years later, they're, you know, it seems like they're living in a nice little new suburb of Mars, and they have their kid and they're happy. I'm like, yeah, that's fine. Like, yeah, they're trying to make things work. And then within the first 10 minutes, Armitage is like, this just happened. Oh, I'm just gonna risk everything, fly to Earth and try to stop this. I'm like, that makes so little sense to me. Yeah. Like, she's about to throw away everything, risk everything just to, you know.
Right, it devalues the ending of the OVA.
Yeah, yeah, for me it really does.
And then as well, Ross becomes some sort of like...
delegate.
Whoops, accidental hero delegate. And then like going into thing where he already knows they're super threatened and he's got a hidden identity and he's literally like on the Mars and Earth like news network, like putting his face out there, even though he's supposed to have a hidden identity and stuff. And then he goes and just leaves his daughter completely unattended. So, of course, she gets kidnapped and then he gets blackmailed. That's just dumb. It's just.
Wow.
I think Dual Matrix as well. It suffers from 2002 AIC animation stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I agree. Like, I think if they had taken the thing and turned it into, like, it's probably would have been harder to sell it that way. But, like, I think they could have made a much better thing if it had been, like, a single, like, 45-minute, like, episode thing.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. It was about 10, 15 years old to drop as a single 45-minute OVA.
Right, yeah. And especially because it seems like Armitage was one of those things where, at least looking at the Japanese language wiki, like they claim that like Armitage, like the OVA, didn't really do well in Japan, but it did much better in the U.S. And then
doesn't surprise me.
And then they were trying to capitalize on like the popularity of like the Ghost in the Shell dub and stuff. So that's why they went for like, hey, can we get a movie version of this? And we'll try and get some big name people. Mm. And put it behind there and put it out that way as the Poly Matrix.
I did want to mention that I was looking it up and this came out the same year as Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah, that wasn't accidental. Yeah. And also the last episode came out after Eva had started. So that's probably going to kill that ending of that in Japan.
It came out against really tough competition. Yeah. We can say that much.
Dual Matrix, I'd kind of be like, especially watching it these days, it's like there's nothing really like to look at there and be like, oh man, this looks cool. Where it's like, I still think there's plenty of good stuff to look at in the original OVA, where there still is like lots of nicely done stuff. You know, it's also cool to see, it's always fun to see cool computer and these other effects done without computers and stuff. But Dual Matrix, I'd kind of be like, meh, it's not great.
That's my general feeling too. Like, there are elements of it that I was like, oh, that's cool, I'm happy to see it. But ultimately, I think it would have just been better for it to not have been made. In my opinion, it ends the property on such a kind of note. Like, at the end of it, they get back and it's like, did anything they do actually matter? Like, couldn't they have just stayed on Mars doing what they have done and they probably would have, like, had the same end result? But I'll leave it at that. I don't want to... I'd rather not allocate too much time for Dual Matrix. I'd rather go back to Poly or Poly Matrix or the original OVAs. As far as, you know, keeping my pleasant memories.
Yeah, that's fair.
Pleasant. I think for me, more than anything, just the setting and the world building that's just done organically is what really impresses me. Like, they don't go out of their way to be like, oh, here's Mars in 2046, and this is how it's done. There's like that in the first scene when Ross gets there and you get to see his apartment, and just him living in it gives you an idea of what life is like there. Like, I love that. That cut is one of my favorites because you see, you know, he's an officer, he's a cop, so you figure he's probably doing okay. And, you know, it's a pretty big place, a huge studio. And then the whole cool thing of, like, the windows are this cool screen, holodeck screen that he can turn into whatever, right, background he wants.
You're skipping over the first thing that blew my mind, which is the space train transport, right, where there's the train carried on a plane that, like, comes off and docks and then
it becomes the train that goes into the actual city. Yeah, true.
So cool.
That's also pretty rad. Yeah, I completely agree. I also feel like it did a great job of melding in the distant future with believable tech, if that makes any sense. Like, I feel like all of the stuff they show off is like, it to me is believable. It's all very industrial, like high tech stuff, which you know, if it has to survive on Mars, you figure it kind of has to be a bit more, you know, utilitarian first and then, you know, form second. But I thought all of it was pretty interesting. Dylan, I know you did what you usually do, and you posted some interesting screenshots of interfaces and keyboards, and you actually input the one that I actually found the most interesting, which was, is this the first animated representation of an ergonomic keyboard? Like, I'm asking a real question. Because when I saw it, I'm like, oh, that's ergonomic. I wonder if this is the first actual, like, application. I mean, even though the person using it was just using talk to type, but you know.
Yeah. So they're using Space Siri to go into their space word processor. Yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting keyboard layout. It's one of those things you look at it, you're like, oh, it's kind of ergonomic, but it's also weird. And you're like, how do your hands go in there? But I could actually see it kind of like, because it's like the keys are, it's four tall by five. So it kind of is an ergonomic thing. In some ways, it's very actually similar to my very fancy split keyboard that I have, where it's got the two different halves are completely independent. It's like if you had that as a single shell. So that's a fair point. It is. I hadn't actually thought of it that way until you said it, but it actually is maybe unintentionally ergonomic, or maybe some animator is just like, no, man, I'm drawing this. This is what I'm a keyboard to be.
I mean, it's existed a hell of a call out.
Did they? 1995? Did they?
I think so.
I guess we can always dig around and
weird looking ergonomic keyboards, but I don't remember exactly when they started showing up.
Yeah, I don't remember either.
I remember a lot of ergonomic mice from the 90s, like all sorts of different designs, trackballs, like vertical and.
Mm-hmm.
But keyboards, I don't remember as much.
One of the things I was a little bit surprised of, because I was watching it dubbed, so like I assumed it was like an interesting kind of poem or something, but then as I paused and looked at the words, and we're talking about the scene where the writer third, she's dictating stuff. But then I looked and realized it was like, oh no, this is literally like animated into the thing as this, because there's all the typical like Japanese, like you can see that it was clearly like animated. Like,
wait,
and
really, you think that they hand wrote that?
I don't. Well, maybe not. Maybe it was typed and put in there. I'm not sure how they did it. I think I noticed like the weird like typo type stuff in there that made me go, oh, this wasn't like an overlay that they did for the U.S. version or something. Like, this was original.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I think. That's
original. Yeah. I mean, it's got too much English in it for
you. Yeah.
How could she geet the ones from the deep far away?
Word processor.
Yep.
it's pretty good. I actually really liked more of their handheld terminal things.
Yeah, definitely.
The UI on that is very much from, that was exactly from that time period of where you had those early, very early personal pocket assistants.
Like Palm Pilots and stuff.
Yeah, PDAs, I guess, you know, they were calling them back then, yeah. Where they had that exact kind of interface where it was like, yeah, a desktop with like, you know, mail and all that kind of stuff where you would click on things.
Where it was literally replicas of things that were in your office or on your desk, not abstracted at all or taking into account that, well, you know what this thing means. It literally had to have an entire thing of like, oh, hey, here's your Rolodex.
I'm noticing now there's a magic lamp as one of the items in the
interface. A genie's lamp.
What is this?
Yeah, we're talking about the little handheld thing and the icons down below. It looks like I can't. There's a genie's lamp. There's one that looks like
a moving van,
a stamp, a moving van, a keyboard, something that looks like a. I don't even know what the others are. The one on
a
the
stationary. It looks like a stationary cup with scissors in it.
Yeah.
I don't know what the far left one is.
Oh, the one in the middle, I think it's like a little like handheld bag or something. And the one on the left is either a bed or a like a very stylized toupee. I'm not sure which.
Oh, okay. I really like it. The whole device seemed kind of absurd and impractical. You never saw anybody actually do anything other than look at it. So
It was basically a fancy cell phone most of the time.
Like, yeah, basically.
Most of they were communicating on it, so.
Seems like basically all they did, but I love, you know, it kind of flips out and it's got the transparent screen. It's way bulky for what it is for a future. I feel like they weren't quite ambitious enough.
I attribute that to, I feel like I'm projecting here, but I feel like it's, again, because, you know, things being put in Mars need to be built a bit more robust just because it's a more extreme area.
Okay.
Like they make it more industrial and let's call it military grade.
Okay, yeah.
As just a necessity is kind of the way I interpret it.
This is like the police version even, right?
Yeah, exactly. So because when you look at the writer's computer, it looks a little bit more, let's call it artsy fartsy.
Yeah.
Like it's kind of got a weird branch thing for the screen and, you know, all that. But
that seems like the most realistic future thing. Like we're not far from that now with like crazy LED case designs and things like that. And,
for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's certainly, I would say, closer to what current high tech is than what Bubblegum Crisis and their keyboard that had the enter key in the middle.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I truly don't understand what
that's
the
true.
Logic
this
there
was. This was more ambitious than that, for sure.
Yeah. And funny enough, both done by AIC. So.
And Chiaki Konaka, he wrote a bunch of BGC 2040.
Mm-hmm.
Not original, but...
Yeah, 2040.
Also, I'm just going to go ahead and jump forward to minute 41 in Polymatrix. So further okay. in the other with Pluto, who puts on his third right officer's hat just for style because it's cool.
That's very Japan.
And also like the leather short pants, like just his yeah. whole aesthetic was interesting.
He had a vibe he was going for.
Honestly, he looks like a Clamp character to me.
He does. Holy cow, dude.
He is. Yeah, very Clamp. Big Clamp vibe. Like a hairstyle, too. And obviously super effeminate, I think, intentional. So
this is their time period, too, right? So
definitely. I mean, their time period went a long
time. Well, yeah. So. That this is like, I think this is the X time period, right?
Yeah,
yeah,
X,
95 would have been.
Yeah, X
or Tokyo Babylon, at the
yeah,
least.
Yeah,
yeah.
At least
yeah, I think X came out in 95, too. I mean, this is like at least a decade after California Crisis and Cafe SS, but you know, there's definitely
and a decade after Urusei Yatsura Beautiful Dreamer and the Nazi Cafe. So
right, so there's no cafe, but there was still a Nazi hat that was on there, which is kind of weird.
It's just very Japan, like they
it
just...
is so Japan, yeah. It's not like he's definitely. Trying to be a Nazi or anything. He's just like, what? It's a cool hat. I like it. I'm putting it on.
Yeah. Jeez, Dad.
I think probably my biggest problem with this is like a lot of just like it just felt so very weird and jumpy with things, and like a bunch of my notes I had on stuff where I'm like, oh, Ross is back in apartment, but he's like, wait, is he in Armitage's apartment? Like, why is he in Armitage's apartment? Like, how'd he get access to there? Like, there's all these things.
I feel like I could explain that part.
Go ahead. Because
this is after she says, you know, she reveals she's a third, and then she runs off. So obviously he's concerned about her. So how'd he get into it? Like, if she's an officer too, they probably have, it's probably like an assigned, let's call it apartment. So, or because he's a cop, he can get authorization to enter, you know, without a warrant, or maybe he had a warrant. I don't know, but he's a cop. He can get in.
Yeah.
And the only thing I think that's a little bit odd and presumptuous is he just leaves, like, for lack of a better term, a voicemail on her personal device, which seems a little bit, you know.
Okay.
Wasn't also like on her picture frame or whatever, or
yeah.
Well,
but it was
that could
for
be
there
that version's. Yeah, but then he also knows she can connect to it through her little device thing. But that's what she does, is she literally listens to it. You know what the next cut after, and then and then that's where she does the whole alley scene with the two creepy dudes. So yeah. I don't know. I don't think that scene is too.
It was a little like unexplained. Like I kind of figured out what was going on, and I was able to kind of make sense in my brain of it, but like it was also kind of like I was confused for a bit, like, wait, what's going on? And then, oh, okay, he's at her place and blah blah.
I also want to talk about 90s OPSEC. Like, oh my gosh, like in Polymatrix, it's like right after that that he's at the apartment of the murdered writer person. And you know, he literally just voices into that person's computer to do like anything with his voice. There's no voice checking of anything. It was just like straight up 90s, like all trust, no OPSEC, just oh yeah, anybody can do anything with any voice on anyone's computer.
Oh yeah, he walks into that the CEO's whatever mansion or something, and he just goes up to the computer and copies everything off it somehow.
To be fair, the VP did say he can look at all the records he wants because he was given verbal permission. So, and then there's like the soundless cut where he's asking the robot secretary or something, and then she lets him back in. So I feel like that was inferred that
well,
he was given.
I don't think so, because he cheats with the cigarette lighter. He's like, oh hey, I dropped my cigarette lighter.
Yeah.
Like they make a big deal out of that he's kind of sneaking in.
Yeah. And also with the other one, with like the voice, like there's no voice checking of unauthorized. You're not the right person. Like, no, you can just do anything from anyone's computer, anywhere. You know,
Wild West.
I got a point. Oh, Wild West.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I just attribute it to he's a cop and he can do what he wants.
Yeah,
that's what I attribute it to.
He definitely did. He did whatever he wanted.
I will say that I read through the synopsis on the English wiki for it, and honestly, and I don't know if some of this stuff comes out of the manga or something else or whatever, but I felt like the synopsis stuff on the Wikipedia article really honestly helped me to understand and explain out a ton of things that were going on and stuff in the background, and actually made things like make a lot more sense and more interesting about like what was going on. And at least for my brain, I had so much trouble like figuring out why and what the heck's happening here and all these things. So it was a weird thing where reading that I'm like, oh, that's what's going on. Oh, that makes more sense, huh? Or like, that's an interesting like thing here of why this was happening.
Yeah,
from stuff.
I think,
yeah, go ahead.
I think that's, yeah, that's kind of putting into words kind of some of my feelings about this is just kind of the general flow of certain things. Maybe needed like an establishing shot or some kind of dialogue to get me from one place to another. Like at one point they're going with Pluto. Sorry, I don't remember his name.
Julian.
Thank you. Yeah, Julian. They're going down into a building on some big lift, and I don't think they explain what they're doing. And then, you know, eventually they get down there and I kind of figure it out, but like, where are they? Why are they? The things like that are just kind of throw me off, but maybe that's just me. I don't know.
No, I very much felt the same, where I was like, it was almost like jump cuts without like establishing the style of the thing as being like jump cuts and making you feel disoriented, where it's like it's supposed to be like a police procedural where you follow from A to B to C and there's other stuff, but then you're like, wait, what happens? I can't follow. Wait, why are we doing this? What's going on? There's another Jean Claude, but it's not, but it's the same one, but it isn't. I don't know what's going on. I had very much the same feeling, and I think that's where my I think that's my biggest fault. I think the animation was particularly, I think they did clean up stuff in Polymatrix, as I said, and I think it looked pretty nice in general.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of good work, particularly that it's AIC, and you know, they often don't do the best work of stuff, but it's one of their better things, I think, honestly.
I agree. I absolutely love the design aesthetic of not just armor, but everything.
Mm-hmm.
Like the characters are setting, like all this, like Ross's car it distinctly looked both modern and classic at the same time, mm-hmm. which is not easy to do. And a very intentional choice. So it's like, oh, the guy was, he's like, oh, is this a manual? He's like, no, it has, you know, it has the, it's been retrofitted to have all the automated stuff, but I like to drive by myself because I don't trust robots. You know, the intentional thing like that. And then just little things like Armitage's gun is like the hot pink, like kind of techie looking gun and stuff like that. Like,
that was cool.
And then her super oversized shades where you see the Matrix effect sideways on them when she's doing her hacking.
And I love
and the hacking in general.
The click when she puts them on and off, I love that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just those, like, a lot of design aesthetics, I really do. I think that's really what is it still does it for me, is the design aesthetic of everything. It just really resonates with me. I don't know if it's just because I have so much familiarity with it, or it's just how I internalize it, but I personally didn't have the, let's call it, sequencing and like, context kind of, questions that you guys have. But again, I mean, I'm the one that did, you know, bring this IP up for reasons I have, you know, attachment to it. So it could definitely be my bias, chiming in there.
Mike, how did you feel on the continuity stuff?
I don't feel like I had too much trouble figuring out what was happening just from general cyberpunk familiarity. Because there were bits that definitely seemed very like parts of Ghost in the Shell and bits that felt like parts of other things.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't really have a hook that grabbed me, though it was... Some parts of it seemed very prescient, and if anything, like, they've not, you know, unaged. Like, they are more relevant now than they were at the time.
All of the stuff of the immigration things and
they
robots.
Took our germs.
Yeah, they literally, at least in the dub, they literally say, "Give us back our jobs."
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's signs in English that actually say something like that during the protest.
Yeah, like, it's like they aren't Martians, and yeah.
Yeah, and I was also thinking about some of the dialogue on trans people and the, like, talk of feminism that they didn't go into, but at least seemed very, you know, why they had a problem with the third would be one of the same reasons that TERFs have a problem with trans people. Let's put it that way.
That was interesting because I bring it up because like feminist history and theory is not my thing, but I was like, it seems like if they have machines that can make babies, that frees up women, but I don't know, maybe it's an argument of like it takes away something that's valuable.
I think the rationale is that it gives too much independence to Mars and Earth didn't like that.
Well, yeah, that part
they want
I get.
Then but... to be dependent on having like Earth women there to actually help with the repopulating and so they can commoditize, right? The population basically. But if Martian companies can just make thirds, that, right? So
yeah, I just didn't get the angle from they were saying, well, Earth is feminist, so they don't like it, which is, you know, I got the political argument. I didn't get the feminist argument.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, that's a good point.
But again, I'm not steeped in that theory, so maybe there's an angle I'm just not seeing.
I feel like it would be from a very, you know, biologically essentialist view of femininity that the ability to reproduce is core. I'm probably not stating this very well, but it's kind of the same vision of what it is to be a woman that a lot of the very radical anti-trans people are stating, and that just seems logical to some people, and to other people seems, you know, very not.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a fair point.
I mean, the only thing, other thing I can think of is the, idea that, I think it's less about femininity, well, it ties into femininity, but also just more, let's call it, you know, they're being more humanist than roboticist, where they're saying, you know, birth should only be something that humans have a right to. It should not be, you know, granted to robots, to androids.
Now, one thought that, I did have about thirds is that they don't make, you know, they're like, oh, a robot that can reproduce, but that requires a working artificial womb, or it's way more significant than they're even treating it. Like, one assumes that artificial wombs must exist somewhere else before they're being built into a robot, right?
That was one I didn't want to think too much about because I felt like it would probably undermine the premise of the series. I just kind of granted them that, like, in this universe, that was a significant thing.
It's less the womb and more, where's the DNA coming from?
Well, yeah, that's why I didn't want to think about it too much.
Yeah, there's that too.
And I don't want to ask a loaded question, but I found it ironic that the robotics company in it was, I believe, called Conception, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And, you know, kind of an ironic name given the context. But what's even more interesting that ties it into current day is there is actually a company called Conception Bio, and their whole platform is taking stem cells and converting them into human egg cells. So we're actually at the stage in technology where it's you can generate one half of what's necessary to, you know, make a fetus through science.
Wow.
So that's a so kind of topical. I thought it was kind of interesting the irony that, you know, it was the two companies that one fictitious, one real, share the same name, but actually kind of have, I would say, similar directions as far as the science that they're working on.
I mean, it kind of makes sense given the name. Yeah.
Yes, definitely. But yeah, I think that's probably one of the areas of deepest, like, discussion you can have for this, right? Is at what point should the thirds themselves have more rights because they can reproduce? Like, is that the only reason? Because I feel like beyond that, the thirds were also way more, for lack of a better term, like, human in their mannerisms, right? Like, in the beginning, everyone was like, I can't believe the country, like, what was her name, Kelly, the country singer? Yeah. Like, I can't believe she was a cyborg. Like, she was so human. So obviously the way it wasn't just the fact that they could conceive, but also the fact that they behaviorally were basically, you know, identical to humans was also probably another factor. And
that one seemed more interesting to me as a point. Like, the being able to have bare children seems like it really only mattered for that one argument to explain, you know, politically why Earth wanted the thirds destroyed. But I feel like you probably could have done without that, just be on the basis of them being more human, right? And being able to replace other humans, like that stuff seemed like more of what people were angry about.
The fact that they were all in art and cultural positions would certainly cause some drama looking at the current arguments over generative AI.
Yeah, also, I'm about to say, also topical.
Yeah, so. I was thinking the same thing as I was watching it. Very big argument these days about, AI taking over what was used to exclusively be a human thing.
I want to go for another sillier, lighter topic, which is that Armitage's fighting abilities. She seems, at least to me, it felt like she went back and forth between, like, being really cool and good and great shot, and other times literally just, like, running in and getting shot 85,000 times and not dodging, or rather than, like, using her kind of her speed and agility and aim and stuff like that, just, you know, we'll just drop a crane on this dude. Maybe that'll hit him. I don't know.
My logic for this is that because she is a third, she's actually less efficient at combat because she is programmed to be emotional like a person, so she can have bad judgment. Where when you think about all the assassinoids and they're like basically like the Don Clods, right? They're all seconds. Like they have an sole express purpose, and so they are purpose, you know, purpose built and purpose motivated. But being a third made her closer to being human, so in that sense, it also made her weaker than traditional cyborgs. That's kind of how I internalize it. But at the same time, because she's special, she also can surpass them given the right circumstances. That's how I kind of interpreted it.
I buy that. I think that makes sense. Well, that's the price that she pays for being more human, is that she's less ruthlessly efficient.
Fair enough. I'll take it.
maybe I missed it, but did they ever describe exactly what the flaw was with the third's brain that they went into that he supposedly fixed at the end?
Well, I thought it was more that he fixed... Are you talking about that the Asakura did, where he...
Yeah.
Well, I thought that it was that he went in and, like, replaced her body, or at least a good portion of it, with the unfinished, I'll call it the warrior body that...
The sister.
I thought that's what was done.
Yeah, my understanding was in her final battle with Don Claude, she was damaged beyond repair, and she was on a short clock. So that's why seeking out Asakura was also important, on top of just finding him again. And then... in the very last moments of, let's call it, you know, Asakura's existence, because this is how I interpret it, is when she first meets him, it's inferred that he, you know, had some sort of induced amnesia, and then he was repurposed for a very specific task, which was terraforming. The terraforming of Mars is kind of how I interpreted it, but then it turns out, at least again from what I understand, is that was actually just an act, and it wasn't until the very end when he, you know, calls her by name and says, you've always been a little fire plug, haven't you? And then he, you know, knocks her out with a stun gun, which I found a little bit interesting, and then it's inferred that he repairs her or transfers her consciousness into the combat body, because then the following let's call it final battle scene, like she goes into freaking battle angel mode.
I figured out that happened. I just was never clear, like, what the actual flaw was with the third's brains, because I thought that Don Claude mentioned that, like, they all had a fatal flaw or something, but maybe I'm just totally...
I think what Don Claude was talking about was all of the Don Claude assassinoids had something, and the reason why the one working with Asakura was okay was because Asakura actually fixed him. I think that's maybe what you're talking about.
I'm not sure. I'll have to revisit it again.
Yeah, that whole segment was definitely a little bit, I would say, fast in developing, but I gotta say, the freaking power suit that Ross gets into, like,
that's cool.
Yeah, that's I big approved that. I don't know, all the aesthetics for that whole battle scene, I greatly enjoyed.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
And I like that they kind of both won and didn't and lost at the same time. Like, yeah, did they survive? Yeah, but ultimately, their end goal was still impossible, because, you know, the military nuked Asakura's entire lab, so all of that work is basically gone, and then all traces of thirds, as far as we know anyway, we're now gone. Like, Armitage is like the last one, only remaining one.
The whole, like, deleted thing on the map was kind of corny, but I also kind of loved it. Like, oh, there's this zone on the map that's, like, deleted, and this is where this secret lab is. I thought I really enjoyed that.
And everyone with Google Maps isn't just going, huh, that's interesting, and right by the highway, let's pay it a visit.
You know what it gave me vibes of? I don't know if, like, for people who have played 13 Sentinels, that, like, is part of the story that you find out pretty early on that, like, nobody realizes that they can't go to this certain area just because their brains have been programmed not to even think about it. I don't know. I thought that was pretty cool, even though, yeah, sure, there's certain, you know, you could think there's a hole or whatever. Like, I don't know. I liked the idea. But I would love for them to explain how they got out of that crazy battle. How did they survive? I want to know.
Yeah, I agree.
They barely did.
Yeah.
That's my interpretation. They barely did.
Give me a movie. Give me a movie, guys.
All right. Well, that hour actually kind of flew by, even with our, let's call it, production mishap for this episode.
But, yeah.
Well, yeah. We've kind of gone all over the place, but, you know, as usual, final thoughts overall about the prop, any specific property or parts of it, or, you know, in general, starting with Mike.
Yeah, I felt like it held up pretty well, like better than I expected it to. Some of the things being debated, as I said earlier, seem very current. So I wish that it was, you know, more legally available, but I think people should watch it if they get the chance.
Gotcha. What about you, Sam?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I watched this back in the day, but I can't remember at all. I remembered basically nothing, except for the opening, like I said earlier. Yeah, it was great. Like I said, the first two episodes I feel are the weaker ones, but the second two are really engaging, and I really enjoyed those. Definitely worth checking out. I feel like I would love I want to say a remake, but I don't know if it's worth a remake. I don't mean that to say it's like worth less, but like maybe I should check the movie out and see how well that edit is. To compare the other two and see if maybe that fixes a lot of my complaints. Yeah, very perfect representation and distillation of that time in anime, for sure.
Yeah, definitely agree there. I'll go next. Yeah, I agree with everything that Sam and Mike said. I personally wouldn't change anything. I think Armitage really encapsulates a period of 90s that it's at the very, very end of a period where it was still it's a feeling thing more than like a technical thing, mm-hmm. but I just felt like there was a certain kind of level of like heartfelt grunge in it that is decidedly 90s and I truly adore, and it definitely transitions out as you get into things from the later 90s. Like a great example being like Cowboy Bebop. I feel like there's even it's just 3 years difference, there's a decidedly different kind of just style and tone of everything. And I'm not saying one is better than the other. It's just I think it's more of just a tonal shift in how animation, you know, was done, and also kind of thematically, you know, from how it's, you know, told story-wise and the way cuts are made. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it's a great example of, you know, kind of like almost a capstone, if you will. I mean, along with Eva, obviously, of kind of, you know, transitioning from early 90s into, you know, late 90s sensibilities. Obviously, if it's not obvious, very near and dear IP to my heart, Armitage herself falls into probably one of my top five favorite characters of all time. I think she's a wonderfully flawed character who's is for me just always is, you know, has a very kind of special place in anime hierarchy. What about you, Dylan?
I honestly, like, I think it's fine. Is it something that I would like recommend to someone to like get into anime or any of those things? Like, no, I wouldn't do that at this point. But if it's something that was like, hey, is there like a cool kind of cyberpunky thing from the 90s that's not Ghost in the Shell, I'd be like, hey, check out Armitage, except you can't check it out anywhere, so good luck. So I think it's fine. It's nothing that I love. I definitely had not ever seen it before, so I don't have any of that. It's also quite possible that I'm less enamored with it because I did watch it dubbed versus not. Which, you know, I never do for anything, but, you know, I'll take that there. Complete aside there, correction from last time or addition, just because I want to get it in there, is on the memory related podcast. It was from Revisionist History, Season 3, Episode 4, episode title Free Brian Williams. It was really another brilliant episode of that podcast. So if you want to listen to a really interesting thing on memory and false memory and real memory, listen to that episode. It's cool. So Armitage, you know, it's cool. I like Polymatrix best of all those things, and I'd be curious to see it, I guess, in the version, because I guess kind of really the official version of it is the dub version, because it was later one of those later re-imports back into Japan, because Polymatrix was made for the U.S. market. So,
all right, we do have also a topic for next time. Next episode, we are going to be talking about the global phenomenon that is Uma Musume Pretty Derby. So,
oh my god,
you guys get to hear the Kenzoku take on that show.
Giddy up.
So,
it only took us, we finally gotten there after, it'll be our 74th episode, is finally onto Uma Musume.
I mean, yeah, I drank the Kool-Aid and I'm fully indoctrinated, is all I'll say.
Oh,
so,
gosh.
I'm glad there's not an hour counter on the mobile game. I probably have like 60, 70 hours on it.
Oh, yeah.
No joke. But we'll save that for next time. So yeah, you have that to look forward to. So with that, this is Amu Kenzoku, signing off. Saraba.